Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 108 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. As you know, one of my favorite things about the Middle Ages is digging into primary sources. And so today I thought I would bring to you a primary source which we haven't talked about too much before, and that is medieval poetry or medieval lyrics. So this is going to be a fairly short episode because this is a really busy time at the end of the post-secondary school term for most of us. So I'm going to be reading 9 medieval poems for you just to give you a sense of what people wrote about and the kind of things they wrote about. A lot of the poetry that was written in the Middle Ages is religious in theme. A lot of it is based on things like grief. I'm avoiding those today because I don't know about you, but I could use an uplifting episode this week. So it's going to be more fun poetry. But again, just to give you a little bit of a sense of what medieval poetry is like. So we're going to start with one that is appropriate to this time of year, when it is the end of post-secondary school term. So there are a lot of us that are busy and finishing up all that stuff. The first poem I would bring to you would be one that is a Latin one from the 12th century that is written, it seems, by a student. And this translation is just called after the first line of the poem or song, which is, "Let's away with study. Let's away with study, folly sweet. Treasure all the pleasure of our youth. Time enough for age to think on truth. So short a day, and life so quickly hasting, and in study wasting, youth that would be gay. 'Tis our spring that's slipping, winter draweth near. Life itself we're losing, and this sorry cheer dries the blood and chills the heart, shrivels all delight. Age and all its crowd of ills terrifies our sight. So short a day, and life so quickly hasting, and in study wasting, youth that would be gay. Let us as the gods do, 'tis the wiser part, leisure and love's pleasure, seek the young in heart. Follow the old fashion, down into the street, down among the maidens, and the dancing feet. So short a day, and life so quickly hasting, and in study wasting, youth that would be gay. There for the seeing is all loveliness, white limbs moving, light in wantonness. Gay go the dancers, I stand and see, gaze till their glances steal myself from me. So short a day, and life so quickly hasting, and in study wasting, youth that would be gay." So that is one by what sounds like a student who is tired of studying and would rather be out amongst the people. We know that students hung out in what was the Latin quarter of towns, which was where all the students were together. And we know that they caused a lot of trouble. This sounds like a student who was probably ready for some trouble, I think, after a lot of studying. So that translation is by Helen Waddell, and it's from her book, which is called Medieval Latin Lyrics, although I have it in a compilation that's just called The Portable Medieval Reader. And a couple pages later, in the same Portable Medieval Reader, is another one that to me sounds like it's a student, again, in that cheery spirit of students, and it's just called This Song Wants Drink. So many of these songs don't have an actual title. They're named after the most important lyric of the poem or the song. And for this one, it's This Song Wants Drink. So here we go. It's from the 12th century, and it's a French one. Who has good wine should flagon it out and thrust the bad where the fungus sprout. Then must merry companions shout, this song wants drink. When I see wine into the clear glass slip, how I long to be matched with it. My heart sings gay at the thought of it. This song wants drink. I thirst for a sup. Come circle the cup. This song wants drink. And that translation is by C.C. Abbott in Early Medieval French Lyrics. But again, it's in my compilation, The Portable Medieval Reader, and we'll have all of the translations for you in the show notes. This one is one of the Fablio, and don't worry, you don't have to turn it off if you're worried about your children. It kind of gets at something that's a little bit racy, but not explicitly like many of the Fablio. This is from the Fablio, translated by Nathaniel E. Dubin, and this one's called The Priest and the Wolf. A priest who lived in the Chartrain loved the wife of another man, a peasant, but he caught on to it and dug a pit along the route the priest took when he came their way. That night, a wolf happened to stray by in the dark and tumbled in, and the priest likewise for his sin. As was his wont, he came a-calling, and before he knew it, in he'd fallen. The wife, annoyed she had to wait for her priest, who was running late, called for her maid, whom she directed, to go find out when he's expected. On her way, the maid passed the pit, and she as well fell into it. The peasant, waking early, thought he'd go and see what had been caught. He found his pit full, and he swore that he'd give all of them what for. He killed the wolf, gelded the priest, and told the maid she was dismissed. On those three, grave misfortune fell, but for the peasant, things went well. The wolf who feasted on his flock, along with the prelate who took his wife's virtue, paid in full measure, one for his meal, one for his pleasure. So usually there's somebody getting tricked in those fabliaux, and it's usually a peasant getting tricked, or a priest this time. This time it's the peasant that comes out on top. Often it's the priest that comes out on top in those. So there you go. One of the fabliaux that is not terribly racy, but still gives you an idea of the sense of humor that people had back in the day. Here's a poem that is much older and also a lot more pensive. It's called The Ruin, generally, and it's from the Exeter Book, which is an old English book. It's missing some parts of it, but this is a really cool one because we often think of us looking back on the past and, you know, the Middle Ages being the past. But this one is about people in the Middle Ages looking even farther back to the past. And that's something that I don't come across all that much. And I think it's really cool. It reminds me of Keats' poem. I think that many of you will probably find that familiar as well. So this one is called The Ruin. It's originally one that was in Old English. Splendid this rampart is, though fate destroyed it. The city buildings fell apart, the works of giants crumble. Tumbled are the towers, ruined the roofs, and broken the barred gate. Frost in the plaster, all the ceilings gape, torn and collapsed and eaten up by age, and grit holds in its grip the hard embrace of earth. The dead departed master builders, until 100 generations now of people have passed by. Often this wall, stained red and gray with lichen, has stood by, surviving storms while kingdoms rose and fell. And now the high curved wall itself has fallen. The heart inspired, incited to swift action, resolute masons skilled in rounded building, wondrously linked the framework with iron bonds. The public halls were bright with lofty gables, bathhouses many, great the cheerful noise, and many mead halls filled with human pleasures, till mighty fate brought change upon it all. Slaughter was widespread, pestilence was rife, and death took all those valiant men away. The martial halls became deserted places. The city crumbled, its repairers fell, its armies to the earth. And so these halls are empty, and this red curved roof now sheds its tiles. Decay has brought it to the ground, smashed it to piles of rubble where long since a host of heroes, glorious, gold-adorned, gleaming in splendor, proud and flushed with wine, shone in their armor, gazed on gems and treasure, on silver, riches, wealth and jewelry. On this bright city with its wide domains, stone buildings stood, and the hot stream cast forth wide sprays of water, which a wall enclosed in its bright compass, where convenient stood hot baths ready for them at their center. Hot streams poured forth over the clear gray stone to the round pool and down into the baths. That was a translation by Richard Hamer in a book called A Choice of Anglo-Saxon Verse. I just think that's a really cool poem because obviously they're looking back on this Roman past, which is something that we do. And again, like I said before, we maybe often think of ourselves as being the ones who look back. And it's a really cool thing, I think, to think of this being a human activity where we often look back to the past, no matter which era we're from. Last week, we talked about The Art of Courtly Love by Andreas Capellanus and this idea that the perfect love at least in terms of courtly love, was one that made you suffer, was one that made you obey ladies, was one that was adulterous, and one that you normally never actually managed to achieve. And this is really based on a culture that works around troubadour poetry. So I thought it was worth reading a little bit of troubadour poetry for you. So this is one by Geoffrey Rudel, Prince of Blaye. And he wrote in the 12th century. So this is really kind of the rise of courtly love poetry. So here's one that he's written that I think if you were listening to last week's podcast episode will sound really familiar in terms of the themes of courtly love. I have many singing masters all around me and mistresses, meadows and orchards, trees and flowers, warbling of birds and cries and songs in this sweet, soft season, for I live in a bubble of joy. And no delight can make me rejoice as much as the presence of valiant love. Let the shepherds have their pipes and the children have their play, and let me have the kind of love that pleases her and pleases me. I know she's every bit as good to her lover, even when the path is hard. Still, I often feel despair that she's not mine, my heart's desire. Far away are the castle and the keep where she lies with her husband, and if I do not soon advance, obeying the counsel of my teachers, no other counsel does much good because my love's so pure at heart. I'll have nothing else to do but die if I don't find joy soon. I say in the land where her joy was born, her neighbors must all be lords. It's a point of honor to me to believe that even the peasants there must be loyal and true. The love that I hold in my heart makes me happy and gives me good will, and I know that she knows this well. My heart is so completely there, it has no tip or root elsewhere. And when I sleep beneath my sheet, my spirit goes to where she lies. My love for her does me harm since I love so much, and she doesn't care. Soon I will see if by suffering I can find the way to rejoicing. My longing hurries away to her through night and by the light of day, going in hope of finding help. At last it returns, and at last it speaks. Friend, she says, jealous brutes have stirred up such a bother that it will be hard for you and me to find peace and have our pleasure. My grief is growing worse and worse because I cannot see her alone. I do not sigh so deeply or weep so long that only one kiss would not make my heart well and strong. This love is good. It has a great power to bring me a cure for this disease without a learned doctor's care. So that's really familiar if you were paying attention last week, right? Love is a sickness. It's going to cause death. The only thing that could cure it possibly is love from this noble lady, even though she's with her husband right now. So that is a troubadour poem for you. And I will have the translation for you in the show notes. If you listen to the podcast, you also know that one of my favorite writers of the Middle Ages is Christina Pizan, and she wrote all sorts of stuff. One of the first things that she wrote that was popular was 100 Ballads. So that has very common themes in it that have to do with courtly love. She writes one about, like, how can this husband keep us apart? It's awful. They're very traditional in the way that she's written them in terms of their themes of courtly love. Many of her poems are also about her grief at being a widow. And I don't know about you, but I don't think this is the time that I want to really get into poetry of grief. So I'm not going to read you any of those. But one of Christine's pet peeves is the idea of courtly love in terms of the way that it exaggerates things and the way that maybe it puts women down. So here is one of her ballads that is kind of a reply to the ideas of courtly love, which I think is a little bit funny. And I hope you enjoy. Wise are those who know how to guard against false lovers who have the habit of ceaselessly betraying women with their words. They complain about the force of love which holds them prisoner like a bird in a cage and pretend they're all pale with love. But I am firmly convinced that he who complains the most is not necessarily the sickest person. When you hear them swear and carry on, pretending to be more submissive than a page at court, go about, reflect, and look around. And when they talk, they twist their tongue in order to deceive, and hardly anyone is the wiser when they complain with such charm and grace. But one can well judge by their faces, he who complains the most is not necessarily the sickest person. May God correct such lovers. Sadly, there are many of them, I believe, who go around asking the ladies for grace and mercy and who send messages with the only aim of gaining advantage. This is why my ballad says that in this case, be he ever so highly placed, he who complains the most is not necessarily the sickest person. So there's Christine speaking against the ideas of courtly love and all the drama that is coming from it, which I think is, it's very Christine. And I love her. One of the other poets who I really enjoy is somebody who is writing in Valencia in the 15th century, and his name is Ausias March. I'm sorry, Spanish friends, if I am completely slaying that name. He is somebody else who writes a lot about grief, and his poems about grief are just so moving that, again, I'm not even gonna get into them, because one of the things I'd like to do for this podcast is to keep it uplifting for you. But I will give you the link to this book, which is Ausias March Verse Translations of 30 Poems, that's translated by Robert Archer. And I will give that to you in the show notes so that you can read these, because they're really, really good. He talks about the love of his life dying, and he also talks about his conflict about not actually believing in God the way he wants to. So this is really great poetry. But I thought I would read you one that is, again, a response to troubadour poetry. And just so you have a bit of a contrast, because I think there might be this idea that all medieval poetry is kind of along the lines of the troubadours. It's all very dramatic and about love, being about the most beautiful woman in the world. She's so pale, she's so blonde, she's just like a gem. And Ausias March is writing against that idea, although you'll see that he's also very flattering to his love. So this is one that's just labeled 23 in the book. I don't need to write like the troubadours, all so inflamed that truth soon left behind. And fervent though it is, I'll quell desire, and only then say what I find in you. On those who have not seen you for themselves, my words are lost, just lies, they will all say. But those who have seen you, yet just the outer self, will know that I speak true. Their hearts will sink. The very dimmest wits could never miss the marks your person bears of noble blood. Discerning eyes will soon perceive much more. A fool views cloth by color, qualities lost. Ignorant men know all about the body, except where spirit also has its part. Much they can say of your cut and hue, but all before your beauty are struck dumb. Yet everyone's a dolt to find the words to paint the beauty of your virtuous form. Nobles, young, and good, and wise have pleaded. Ever will they hunger. So must it be. Equal to yours, there is no other mind. The subtlest concepts lie within its grasp. Sloth must sleep as your goodness does its work. Not virgin, but mother, such was God's will. You he formed from the substance he saves from making special women of great worth. He created many such, most wise and good, yet perfect none but Lady Teresa. Others, in her wisdom, far excelling. Nothing lies beyond the reach of her wit. Devoutest gaze is by her beauty stunned. Her mind is bred to feed enlightened minds. Venice, the most serene, can only envy your mind's calm governance of subtlest thoughts, sole nourishment of your understanding, and the guiltless movements of your lovely form. Enlightened men set all their wits to grasp your thoughts, reaping from them such rare delight that bodily desire can never stir, and all base urges slumber undisturbed. Lily among thorns, would I had the power to place an unseen crown upon your head. No other crown will do. The kind that's seen must ill befit a living miracle. So that's kind of a nice poem. That's really praising her wit and her mind, saying she's so much better than everyone else because she's brilliant and a living miracle. I think that's a pretty nice one, even though it does really get into over flattery and mentioning that, of course, she's beautiful as well. So here is a poem that is just silly. It is called A Galliard's Feast. That's not the real title. As with so many other medieval things, they are titled so that scholars can figure out what they're talking about, but many of these don't actually have titles in the Middle Ages. A Galliard is a student, again, a student who writes poetry that's a little satirical and fun. This one is called The Galliard's Feast because it's all about food. and the things that would make the scholar, the student happy. And I thought it was super fun, so I'm bringing this to you. When I see the return of winter that so afflicts me, as the weather changes, then I love a split log. The crackling coal, the blazing brands, the big logged hearth fire sings with joy. Indeed, I love it so much, my whole body sweats. When bedtime comes, what surely pleases me is a faggot in the hearth that's kindling. Dry without smoke, which burns entirely and turns to embers. I quite often scratch myself, the worst is the spine, for the flesh stinks a lot and is ill-dressed in clothes. I love greatly the daytime, for then, by means of heat chasing it so, the cold is sent outside and is gone. This is my delight, to have a good bed of white cloth with a fresh smell. A thin blanket makes me miserable. Wool, not fur-lined, I don't care for that, for it's of no use. I like the fires better. When I see the cold, I go to the fire. I like its play better than two weighted dice. When the winter extends through the morning, indeed, I'm sorely grieved by the snow and frost, as into slick ice it is transformed, little slivers in the fog. Some roasted boar from good pasturage, the loin unburnt, thrust on a skewer, that's to my taste. I've given all my holdings for one good morsel with a good claret, with a strong table wine. I much prefer that to smoky beer. I've much loved the tavern. There's no reason to hate it. I've given all my love to a flavored brew with galangale, with zeduary, mixed with hot pepper. It's not bad around Christmas. Mustard with salted meat. Geese and mallards, coots and moorhens, capons on canvas, roasted hens, swans, peacocks, cranes, herons, teals, wild geese, and tufted ducks. And stuffed pig, the interlarded loin, I've much loved that. I don't hate venison at all, nor flesh from hunted deer, nor buck, nor boar, veal with dried apple. Ham, freshly salted, has restored me to life. When I'm beside the tun and it rains and thunders, there's always plenty for me. Wine of the best quality. Stewed hare, larded rabbit. He's crazy who'd refuse a bit of soft cheese when I've toasted it and crowned it with gooseberries. Cookies and cakes, rissoles and waffles, toasted golden brown. Partridges, plovers, doves from dovecote. Woodcock is good to eat. And larded chitterlings. I take for a fool any who puts his goods in hock for smoked tripe. For when I revive around noon, my innkeeper has a word with me. He says he recommends at bedtime a hot pot of peeled chestnuts. During the 40 days of Lent, then I love scaled perch, tench turned over and immersed in broth, herring, plaice, and fresh fish, and shad in pastry, baked breads lightly grilled, and salted custard tart. Dace I don't hate at all, split elegantly, freshwater eel, its skin removed, conger eel, sturgeon, pike, salmon, gudgeons, bream, nor gurnard, nor cod with garlic, nor shelled crayfish, nor roach, nor lamprey, nor cold skate. Mackerel, fresh and newly caught, and all other good morsels that have emptied many a purse. When Easter returns, I quit being quiet. I have tarts and flan made to close up the season. I dearly like mutton with fat kidneys, so I have a lamb skinned out of its fleece, intending to spice it with crushed pepper. It's good to have mutton with leek pottage, chicken on weekdays, goose fattened in a pen, then new stains on the tablecloth. A roast head after cooked goose, and a fat kid in lard wouldn't displease me. To close up the meal, pig's feet in sauce, from the cold storeroom and the upper sunroom, with spicy nutmeg sprinkled on lightly, and then I send myself to sleep. So I kind of love that one. It talks about all the things that a student would love, right? I'm cold all the time. I love a warm fire. I love being warm in my blankets. And I love the part where he's saying, when he wakes up at noon, the innkeeper speaks to him. I love this idea of a student's dream. What they would do, basically what they would do if they were rich and they could have whatever they wanted. So that's a Galliard's Feast. And that's from the Harley 2253 manuscript. I'll have that in the show notes for you as well. So finally, I thought I would end with a song that talks about May, because it's May now and spring is around the corner. At least I hope so. I really hope so. This one is just called the 28th Dance Tune, and it's from The Service of Ladies by Ulrich von Lichtenstein, who actually was a real person. I did write an article about this on medievalist.net, so if you're wondering a little bit about Ulrich von Lichtenstein, he was a real person. And he wrote this book called The Service of Ladies. It is a wild ride, let me tell you. And he has some lyrics in it. This is one that's just, like I said, called The 28th Dance Tune. This is a translation by J.W. Thomas. And I thought it would be a good way to wrap up our poetry episode. In the warm and fragrant Maytime, when the woods are dressed in green, through the happy hours of daytime, all that loves in pairs is seen. Every heart is filled with bliss, and the spring was made for this. Loving pairs in pleasant hours soon are free from all distress. In the hearts of both their flowers, all the season's happiness. Sorrow love cannot abide when two loves are side by side. When two loving hearts are plighted faithfully without deceit, when the two are so united that their love must be complete, they are joined by God to capture all that life can hold of rapture. Constant love is Minna, truly, love and Minna are the same. I cannot distinguish duly aught between them but the name, nor can tell the two apart, love is Minna in my heart. Find a heart that does not vary, constant love and constant mind. Then with grief you can be merry, constant love is good and kind, and to constant hearts will give constant pleasure while they live. If I ever found enduring love, then I would surely be always loyal, with it curing all the cares that come to me. Faithless love will never do. I must find a love that's true. So that is from Ulrich von Lichtenstein's The Service of Ladies. And, well, it might read differently if you actually know anything about Ulrich and how constant his love was. I should probably mention that Minna is a German word, and from the small bit that I know about it, it is courtly love. So when he says love is Minna, it's love is this height of love, the courtly love that people talk about in troubadour poetry. So I hope you've enjoyed this little walk through medieval poetry. Although all of those were in translation, I hope it gives you a little bit of a sense of the type of stuff that people would put in their poetry in the Middle Ages. Although we did have a little bit of troubadour poetry in there, it's not all courtly love stuff. Sometimes there's really silly stuff about wanting a drink or really great food or sleeping late or, you know, Christine's pithy response to the ideas of courtly love. So again, all of these will be in the show notes. Some of my favorite writers here, poets, Christine de Pizan, Ausias March is so great, Ulrich von Lichtenstein, there's nobody like him, and the Fabliau, although if you have delicate sensibilities, maybe skip that one. But all of these are stuff that I really enjoy, and I hope that you will enjoy too, and take the time to check them out. They will all be there for you in the show notes. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey. Well, I've been reading The Secrets of Women.
Well, after last week's discussion, I think that's important.
Indeed. I felt I needed to learn it. It's this 14th century medical treatise about women's health, kind of pregnancy, offspring, how the planets affect it, all that kind of stuff. But I am getting ready a piece on whether or not you know if it's going to be a boy or a girl that you're going to have.
A gender reveal party for the Middle
That's
Ages.
Right. That's right. It looks good and, you know, involves, you know, positions and urine and probably temperament as well.
Sounds like fun. It sounds like so much fun. We can hear you waving the book around. So that's exciting stuff.
Indeed. I keep it close to me. So this week, we've got some really good kind of pieces from our writers. We have the story of John of Plano Carpini. He is the Franciscan monk that in the 1240s visits the Mongol Empire. We have a piece on that. We have another piece on Pierre's Plowmen and the Texas relationship to the 1381 Peasants' Revolt. So I thought it was a pretty good read. And finally, also, you have to check out how Assassin's Creed, the video game, is now a children's book series.
What? Assassin's Creed? Like, it's got the word assassins in it.
Yeah, like when I say children's, I'm talking like preschooler.
Oh, I'm going to have to check out this article, because that that's blown my mind right now.
Indeed, indeed. I believe you can now already get the books. So if you're reading up us on pregnancy advice, then you can read up on like what you can get your children, your newborn, get them started in middle ages.
Sounds like great advice. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of great stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our amazing maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. There's still a bit of time left to join this session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators and work with me and my fellow instructors to get all sorts of visual research materials to make your medieval fiction even juicier. I am so happy to announce the addition of two new instructors for this session. Rounding out our content on combat, we have Guy Windsor demonstrating even more sword techniques. And we've gotten more medieval food, from peasant fare to banqueting, with Neil Buttery. The next session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators starts May 7th. For more information, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from poetry to preschool assassins, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5minmedievalist. And you can find my books, including pre-ordering the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.